12:30 p.m. and the viewing of the documentary starts at 2:30 p.m. In cooperation with the Huntington Society of Canada, WeHaveAFace.org looks forward to this educational and free event. Please visit WeHaveAFace.org/Canada.
Alexander Hall is a physically accessible location.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
If I say I want peace, then you say you should put down your gun. But hasn't it occurred to you by now, after 400 years of being brutalized and murdered and lynched and maimed by guns and force on the part of racists and the racist power structure in this country, it's damn near time we picked up the gun to try to begin to get some peace, to defend ourselves and our community from racist attacks by the pigs, to defend ourselves against racist attacks by Birchites or Minutemen or Ku Klux Klansmen or what have you? Hasn't it occurred to you that it's damn near time we organize ourselves in some fashion to have some ability to begin to make racist and the racist power structure act in a desired manner as we define the functional definition of what power is? The ability to define the situation, and we have been defining it. Now we must organize in our black communities to also make the power structure and the racist system act in a desired manner. And what is that desired manner? Politics. What is politics? What is politics? You think politics starts with a seat in the assembly? No, it doesn't. It's related to it, but it doesn't start there. Politics starts with a hungry stomach. Politics starts with a pig crushing us across our skull and murdering our people. Politics starts with the fact that we get a rotten education, we get brainwashed and fooled and a trick notion and trick knowledge and everything else that goes on with us in terms of the exploitation that goes down. Politics starts with the fact that we want decent housing, fit for shelter of human beings. Now this is where politics starts. And black people now understand with the Black Panther Party that we are going to relate to politics in a real fashion. We are not going for no more jive verbal sincerity at all. Don't give me Robert F. Kennedy your jive shuck. I think it is necessary here that we come forth. I don't want to hear it. I'm tired of my black brother being brainwashed too. Kingfish, what did you think about John F. Kennedy? Robert Kennedy? Well, Andy, you know how it go there, boy. I think the boy is going to do something there. Look, we're not going for that thing anymore. Robert F. Kennedy was well related to Robert Williams being put in a situation where he had to vamp from this country and split because he was being prosecuted by Robert F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy did not send troops into Birmingham in 1963 until black people decided it was necessary for them to defend themselves. When Martin Luther King's motel was bombed and the races had been attacking us constantly in that particular area and all over this country, why didn't John F. Kennedy send some troops in then? He didn't send troops in until after black people decided we're going to defend ourselves from racist attacks and went to the streets and whooped up a few racist heads. Then John F. Kennedy decided to send in troops. See, all that verbal sincerity, we learn from the past. We learn. So we're going to guide our feet by the lamps of the past. And we're going to make sure that we won't fall into more bags. So peace and freedom, if you want to do something, get down to nitty gritty and don't miss no nits or grits. No more shucking and no more jiving with the McCarthys, with the Lynching Baines Johnson, with the Governor Regans, with the Robert F. Kennedys, right on down the line. No more shucking and jiving.
10 years before I saw the light. To try and stem the rise in such a time. Franco's eyes were the powerful and wealthy. A crying sign came from the other side. Even the olives were bleeding. As the battle for bitter days on and on.
group in love against the force of evil. Brotherhood against the fascist hand. But when we put in 17, they didn't put over. When the VNA here to hold the gun, from Dublin to the Via del Rio, where he fought and died beneath the Spanish sun. Many Irish heard the call of Franco, joined Hitler and Mussolini too. Propaganda from the Portland newspaper had the lucky to enlist in Blue Shirt crew, and the working from the church support the Nazis, and the men of Clough failed again. But the bishops blessed the blue shirts in delirium, and the sail beneath the swastika to Spain. Viva la Quinta Regalia, no pastoral bless the dead and fight. Adamante is the crier on the hillside, let us all remember them tonight. This song is a tribute to Frank Ryan. That's Conway and Jimmy Cody too. A Peter Daly, Charlie Reagan and Hugh Morris. Though many died and have but never feel. Tommy Doyle, the Lippert and Charlie Donnelly. Liam Thomason and Jim Stanley from the ball. Tommy Patton and Frank Conroy, Jim Foley, Johnny Fox and Dick O'Neill. Viva la Quinta Regalia, no passing on the pledge that made him fight. Adelante is the crier on the hillside, and so remember them tonight.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and that was Christy Moore with Viva la Quinta Brigada. And that was his song about the Spanish Civil War and the Irish volunteers of the 15th Brigade of the International Brigades who fought in Spain in that struggle against fascism. Now, and of course, before that, we had Bobby Seale with No More Shucking and Jiving. Now, I think both of those two pieces have an underlying theme, because one of the things I really want to talk about here tonight, it's one of the things that's really been troubling me and troubling many communists, certainly, over the last really last multiple years. And really, that comes down to politics. It comes down to politics, and it comes down to the kind of faces on the progressive left that people are told that they must support, you know, that are the alternative. They're the alternatives that are being put forward to the, say, the mainstream candidates. You know, this is people like Bernie Sanders. Even to some extent, it's someone like Justin Trudeau, who was like portrayed as this like progressive champion last year in the federal election here in this country. It's people like Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, you know, the Labour leader who is proclaimed as like, you know, a champion of progressivism there. And these kind of people, you know, now of course you have Justin Trudeau claiming he's a feminist and he's out there like, you know, claiming he's everything to everyone, putting, you know, photos online of him doing yoga stunts or something like that on tabletops and all this sort of stuff, like something he did years ago. You know, these people are, they're showmen. They really are showmen. One of the things, of course, Bobby Seale talks about, and certainly this was in the African-American experience in the 1960s, they realize fundamentally, you know, both as working people and as an oppressed nationality within North American society, they could rely on no one but themselves. You know, they couldn't rely on these kind of, these faces, these progressive, you know, faces put forward by the establishment who supposedly are a champion for their rights. They realize this is not the way it is. They can't rely on people like John F. Kennedy. They can't rely on people like Lyndon Johnson with his war on poverty and all this other kind of stuff. They can't rely on these kind of liberal, social democratic kind of politicians to stop them from being murdered by police, you know, brutalized by a racist system or excluded from opportunity or what have you. You know, they can't rely on them. They can only rely on themselves. And that's a very crucial thing for working people of all backgrounds, of all skin colors, of all, you know, racial, ethnic backgrounds to really understand. Because really across this country and around the world, hopeful hearts are waiting for a false liberation. Whether it comes in the form of an indigenous justice minister, as in this country, more black police chiefs in America, you know, or Bernie Sanders. People are awaiting false messiahs. Working people are awaiting false messiahs. People who they believe will end their suffering and abuse, you know, without bloodshed and with minimum fuss. It was the same reason why people were euphoric when Barack Obama was elected president and when Justin Trudeau was elected prime minister. The politics of representation still holds too many hearts and minds captive. You know, people want to believe. They want to believe so much that they ignore the evidence before them. They ignore the inconvenient truth that their champion, Bernie Sanders, supports drone strikes and supported the imperialist destruction of Libya and Yugoslavia supposedly in the name of human rights. They also ignore the inconvenient truth that this feminist, the so-called feminist, Justin Trudeau, just passed a budget, a federal budget that does nothing to empower women. You know, whether that's indigenous women or women in general. Nothing. Nothing to empower them whatsoever in a meaningful way. And they give Barack Obama a pass for 6 years as black men and women were being murdered with impunity on America's streets because he, you know, the land of slavery's first black president was supposed to protect them. He was supposed to protect African Americans. But African Americans thought that this black president would protect them from the police. And he never did. The cold hard truth must be realized. There is no salvation for the exploited under capitalism. The exploited, the marginalized. There is no salvation for the colonized under colonialism. Doesn't matter if you have an indigenous person as your justice minister. It's not going to stop indigenous people in this country from being brutalized by the police. And it doesn't matter if you, and imperialism can wear many faces. as we know from Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. We must not allow ourselves to be fooled, brothers and sisters. We must not be fooled. Real change cannot be made until one sees the world as it really is. You know, we need to understand what's going on. Knowledge. Really is our best weapon as working people. You know, and we can see that in Ontario with this recent, you know, craze about free tuition. Supposedly the Kathleen Wynne Liberal government, you know, making free tuition for university students. Needless to say, that did not happen. It is not free tuition by any means. What it basically is a means-tested welfare program, I suppose you could call it, for students, which is only going to affect a tiny minority of students. It's going to be means-tested. There's going to be all kinds of fine print. There's going to be a lot of conditions that have to be met for you to get any sort of grant money or relief for your tuition fees or any of that sort of stuff. So it's not free tuition at all, and yet it was hyped up like crazy. It's this sort of thing we have to be informed about. We can't allow ourselves to be taken in. You know, we can't allow false hope to claim us and override our critical faculties. Because that's when we lose the ability to really fight for our own interests. When we allow ourselves to be fooled. And of course, I think one of the main things that we really have to understand is we have to understand the function that political leaders, holders of political office, have under a capitalist system. Now, Michael Parenti did an amazing job in his book, Democracy for the Few, outlining the institutional role that the American president plays. And very similar things can be said about Canadian prime ministers. In terms of maintaining the system, maintaining the structure of the system, maintaining things like institutional racism, even if they're a black man, in the case of Barack Obama, because he sure as hell did not eliminate or even seriously undermine or seriously challenge institutional racism in America in the entire time that he was in office. And that time is coming to a close. So if he's got like a rabbit in his hat, he'd better pull it out. That's all I can say. You know, these people are the guard. In Michael Parenti's words, these executive leaders under capitalism, the prime ministers, presidents, what have you, they're the guardians of the system. And in many cases, it's their job to portray themselves as champions of the people and of popular interests, when in reality, what they're serving is the profit motives of the big corporations and the wealthy. It really is a PR game that they play. And that's the subject of what Michael Parenti has to say about a talk which he gave about the President of the United States and the kind of power that they wield. But like I said, it can apply to, you know, executive leaders throughout the capitalist world. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm going to play that for you now.
The authors of American government textbooks like to point out that the president plays many roles. He has many roles. He's not only chief executive, we hear, but he's also the leader of his party. He's a chief legislator in the sense that he proposes a legislative program. He's in the policy process. And he's also commander-in-chief. And he's also the head of state, the way sort of the Queen of England is, you see. He's an embodiment. When I wrote my American government textbook, Democracy for the Few, with a sort of anti-textbook, actually, I said, there's another role that he has, which none of these other books have mentioned. He's the guardian and representative of capitalism. He's the embodiment of the executive-centered state system that defends American corporate interests at home and abroad. I'm quoting from one of my favorite authors right now, as a matter of fact. Every modern president has had occasion to praise the free enterprise system and denounce collectivist alternatives. William Shannon's description of President Ford, back when William Shannon used to criticize conservatism. President Ford, it could easily apply to any number of other presidents. Quote, he follows the judgment of the major international oil companies on oil problems. in the same way that he amiably heeds the advice of other big businesses on the problems that interest them. He is a solid believer in the business ideology of rugged individualism, free markets, and price competition, virtues that exist more clearly in his mind than they do in the practices of the international oil industry. Unquote. The president is, I maintain, the top salesman of the system. He conjures up reassuring images about the State of the Union. Nixon, America is number one. Reagan, America is standing tall. America is the greatest. This is what Ronald Reagan was saying to a nation with 35 million citizens living below the poverty level, millions unemployed, hundreds of thousands homeless, a record trade deficit, and a runaway national debt. Whether Democratic or Republican, liberal or conservative, the president tends to treat capitalist interests as synonymous with the nation's well-being. Presidents greet the accumulation of wealth as a manifestation of a healthy national economy. Regardless of how that wealth is applied or distributed or what's it being used for. I mean, what's this wealth being used for? Is it being used to make more yachts? Or is it being used for housing for working people? Ronald Reagan, quote, America will achieve new heights spurred on by freedom and the profit motive. Ronald Reagan, I want America always to be a country where someone can become a millionaire. Ronald Clinton. Ronald Clinton on the McNeil Lair. Quote, this is a free enterprise country, said President Clinton. I want to create more millionaires in my presidency than Bush and Quayle did. What an ambition. What a goal. He didn't say that during the campaign. During the campaign, he was Jesse Jackson. When he got into office and started setting up, he was Jimmy Carter. Now he's Ronald Reagan. Now he wants to outdo Bush and Quayle. Presidents describe the overseas investments of giant corporations as U.S. interests. Those giant interests are called U.S. interests abroad to be defended at all costs. Certainly at great cost to the U.S. populace. A president's primary commitment abroad is not to democracy, but to free market capitalism. And they are beginning to say that a little more candidly. It's probably not easy for a president to remain keenly aware of the suffering and the travails and the deprivations endured by the great mass of people throughout the world, including a lot of ordinary working people in this country. I mean, the president lives like a monarch, a potentate, in utter opulence. He lives in a rent-free, 132-room mansion called the White House, set on an 18-acre estate with a personal domestic staff of about 100 people, including 7 butlers and 5 full-time florists. A well-stocked wine cellar, tennis courts, a private movie room, a private gymnasium, a private bowling alley. Lyndon Johnson must have put that one in. And a heated outdoor swimming pool. And this is a guy who's got to pose as a man of the people who's concerned about ordinary folk. In addition, the president has the free services of a private physician, including all those presidents who didn't want people to have health insurance and socialized medicine, and that would be too much and all that. They should pay for their own medical care. They all had free medical care themselves. See, it's different when you have it for yourself. You understand? It's different. That's what Norman Bradbury is pointing out. It's you out there sacrificing for the country, but I get my family out from downwind. You preach one thing out there, and you do something else. The president also has a dozen chauffeured limousines, numerous helicopters and jets, including Air Force One, and he has access to the imperial luxuries of Camp David and other country retreats, free vacations, a huge expense allowance, and then for those very few things he must pay for out of his own pocket, he gets a salary of $200,000 a year. Journalists and political scientists used to like to write, it was a real fad back in the late 50s, early 60s, I used to describe the presidency as a man-killing job. Well, you know, closer investigation shows that presidents actually probably work a shorter day than the average working man or woman who really has to put in hours. That presidents take more vacations and they live far better and longer than the average American male, including the average middle-class white male. And after leaving office, by the way, they continue to feed off the public trough. Five ex-presidents we have now, all of them multimillionaires, yet each one receives from $500,000 to $700,000 in annual pensions, office space, staff, and travel expenses, along with full-time Secret Service protection that costs $5 million for each of them. I mean, $5 million for Gerry Ford? Well, is the president too powerful or not powerful enough? Actually, I think both the liberals and conservatives are consistent in both those inconsistent charges. Presidents are not powerful enough when working with mass interests, working for mass interests, I should say, and opposing corporate and financial interests. But the president is very powerful when engaging in the converse, when he's working for corporate interests and when he's working against mass interests. The president is very powerful when he's exercising state power. That whole theory, by the way, when liberals started talking about the imperial presidency, the Republicans hadn't gotten elected yet. There wasn't any Nixon or Ford or Reagan in yet. They were already talking about LBJ, and they were talking about Vietnam. And it occurs to them how irresponsive, unaccountable this power was, as millions of people were saying, get out of this war. And this war, these guys were still going ahead and doing it. And they're saying, my God, this president is an autocrat in a way. Well, on certain kinds of issues, and the closer he is to the state, he is. He suddenly understands that the power of that office was not imbued in the office. The power of that office was there as long as that office served powerful interests. By the way, this is true of Clinton also, what I've just said. What you have here is a structuralist argument. This is this argument of the structuralist versus the functionalist. The structuralists say that the system prefigures what the people can do who go into it. And the functionalists say, no, the people who go in can make a difference. And it's all the question of which guy's in there. Is it a good guy or a bad guy? If it's a good guy, we'll get good policy. If it's a bad guy, we'll get bad policy. The structuralist says that regardless whether it's Tory or Labor, there must still be basic concessions and provisions to those who control the jobs, investments, and market forces, who control the other levers of the state. The structuralist argument is essentially correct, but it's over-applied. Because it's one thing to say that the structure is an inescapable overriding social formation that sets fundamental limits, and it's another thing to say that the structure predetermines all policy outcomes all the time. You can't say that. You get too abstracted, too mystical. I mean, Reagan and Thatcher demonstrated that it does make a difference who's elected. So the functionalists do have a point, that within certain parameters, it does make a difference who's on the Supreme Court, who staffs the departments, who makes decisions in the regulatory agencies and in Congress. It does make a difference. It determines what laws are passed and how they're enforced or how they're ignored.
Down now, I'm way down now. Some faces get on
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was World Party with Way Down Now. That was actually a song about the Thatcher years in the UK by World Party. And of course, we had Michael Parenti talking about the institutional role that the presidency plays in American politics, you know, and how it's the guardian of the capitalist class, you could say, the guardian of the capitalist state. And, you know, you have this very, very privileged multimillionaire who has to portray himself as a man of the people, basically, is what you get, or a woman of the people, if, in the case of, you know, Hillary Clinton, if she gets in, which is going to be a scary show, seeing how much of an imperialist she is. But you see what Parenti said about Bill Clinton and the kind of campaign that he ran in the early 1990s when he was running originally against the Republicans, in 1992, I think, is when that was going on. And he says, like, on the campaign trail, Clinton was Jesse Jackson. You know, he was portraying himself as a man of the people. He was portraying himself as this really progressive voice, all this sort of stuff. And, you know, in office, he's more like, you know, for a little while, he's more like Jimmy Carter, the kind of policies he pursues. But pretty soon, he's basically Ronald Reagan, you know, outright, you know, cutting Social Security, cutting, benefits to, cutting food stamps, cutting welfare programs, you know, cutting, all the kinds of support that low-income people get in the United States, you know, giving all kinds of subsidies to big business, you name it. You know, he's doing it all the kind of stuff that Republican presidents do, all this sort of stuff that, that benefits the capitalist class, and basically results in increasing oppression of working people. He was doing that. You know, and this is the kind of stuff that you see again and again with politicians, and it seems like we're seeing that with Trudeau in this country. You know, like he's coming in after this hated, you know, conservative prime minister, conservative administration, Stephen Harper, but he ultimately pursues many of the same policies. Whether that's with regard to oil pipelines, whether that's with regard to, like, you know, subsidizing big business, whether that's with regard to, like, all the different elements of the capitalist state. You know, social spending, you know, all that kind of stuff. He's pursuing many of the same policies. I mean, you know, foreign policy, the same kind of stuff. You know, I can't remember who actually made this quote, but I found this on Facebook as a commentary on really how things are going with regard to the Trudeau government and the kind of continuity that's going on between the Harper government and the Trudeau government. And it basically goes like this: torture states, you know, obviously referring to Saudi Arabia, still get their arms deals from the Canadian government. Canadian mining companies in Africa and South America still have their death squads and their private security that, you know, beats down local opposition to mining interests. The occupation of Palestine gets propped up. You know, Trudeau still backs Israel to the hilt. First Nations still boil their water, you know, and go without health care. And the homeless shelters are even fuller now than they were before. And the food bank lines are longer than ever before. You know, but it's much more photogenic than it used to be. It's much more photogenic than it used to be. All these problems are still there. Similar policies are being pursued. But the guy who's in charge is more photogenic than Stephen Harper was. He says that's mainly the difference. You know, it's sad, but that basically is true for the most part. You know, and of course people want to believe in Justin Trudeau. They want to believe in Bernie Sanders. They want to take their words at face value. You know, Justin Trudeau says he's a feminist. People want to believe he's a feminist. You know, especially women who have been dealing with a lot of BS, like, from the Harper government for the last, like, 10 years. You know, they want to believe things are getting better. But, of course, because people want to believe, they are willing to ignore or dismiss, you know, information or evidence that is contrary to what they want to believe. Ultimately, they want to believe that they live in a good society, you know, a good country with good leaders. Because what's the alternative? It's for the same reason that people want to believe that the USSR was an evil empire. Because if it wasn't, What was the Cold War all about? What was this, you know, threat of Armageddon and nuclear annihilation all for? You know, reality is a scary place, brothers and sisters. But if we're going to change it, you know, if we're going to really change it, we're really going to change reality in a really radical way into something better, we must first learn to confront reality, however horrible it is. You know, if we continue to live in fantasy worlds and rely on wishful thinking, we will get nowhere. And the oppressors and exploiters of the world will keep winning at our expense as working people. We have to cut through the nonsense and learn to see what's really going on, just like Bobby Seale talked about in the No More Shucking, No More Jiving clip, which I played at the beginning of this episode. We need to see what's going on. We need real awareness of our interests as working people, as well as the interests of our capitalist opponents and oppressors. We need to understand who we are and our place in the world as working people, because if we don't understand our place in the world, we can't relate to anything else. And this is a very important thing because, of course, the political establishment in this country, you know, trains us to ally our interests with people like Justin Trudeau, with people like Stephen Harper, with bourgeois interests. You know, with these kind of people whose basic job is to prop up the Fortune 500. That's their main job. And then to make us believe that they're you know, really our guy. You know, they're really in our corner. When, of course, they're not. You know, the stakes could not be higher in the world today. You know, we're seeing wars. We're seeing, like, you know, global warming. We're seeing, you know, all kinds of massive free trade deals going through, which are going to dramatically affect the livelihoods of Canadians and people around the world. And, you know, capitalism is on the offensive. And working people are on the back foot. And we can't afford to fool around and jump on all these false messiah bandwagons. We can only rely on ourselves as proletarians. You know, we have to work together. We have to focus. And we have to learn to fight against the real enemy. It's knowledge, brothers and sisters. You know, proletarians must have knowledge of themselves, of their oppressors, and of the world if they don't want to be taken advantage of. Knowledge is power, and working class knowledge means working class power. You know, and that's the truth. That's one of the reasons why I decided to play the song which Christy Moore did, you know, Viva la Quinta Brigada, like, you know, about the heroic Irish volunteers fighting in the 15th Brigade in the Spanish Civil War against fascism. That's real working class history right there. That's revolutionary history. That's our history. You know, we had the Mackenzie Papineau Brigade from Canada that went over and fought in that war against fascism in the 1930s. You know, and there were Canadians who gave their lives struggling against fascism in the Spanish Civil War and in World War II. You know, that's real working class history right there. Yet it's never taught to us as such. You know, we're never told that we have interests. We're never told in school that working people have interests that are autonomous, you know, from the interests of big business and, like, these, you know, these mainstream political parties that represent big business and the capitalist class. We're not taught that we have interests that are totally different from them, totally the opposite of them. You know, we have to honor our history. We have to know our history as working people. You know, and that's why it's so important also to understand, like, these, you know, the revolutionary societies that arose in the 20th century, you know, like, from a real cutting through the propaganda about the Soviet Union and about China and about Cuba and about all these places. You know, for that matter, about, like, things like the Winnipeg General Strike, you know, or the different, like, class struggles that took place, or the October Crisis, the different class struggles which took place in this country, you know, which are always downplayed. Like, we really need to know who we are if we want to really fight for our interests as working people. You know, absolutely crucial thing to understand. Absolutely crucial thing. You know, and it's very difficult. Like, this is the last thing I'll say before I, like, I switch over. But, you know, reactionaries They can make you believe in all kinds of nonsense. You know, they can create witch hunts. They can create all kinds of scaremongering campaigns. They can make you afraid of, like, this leader in a foreign country who hasn't done anything to affect your life. But now, like, all of a sudden, he's like, you know, the devil. He's public enemy number one, which is what they did with Saddam Hussein, what they did with Slobodan Milosevic, and what they did with Gaddafi, and what they did with all these people. You know, they can make you afraid, and then they can make you a collaborator with the system, with imperialism, with capitalism, and make you an accomplice in atrocity. You know, that's what they can do. I mean, one of the things I just looked at, I mean, if you want to, like, see how easy it is, you know, and this is a particular case, but I mean, if you want to see how easy it sometimes is for this sort of stuff to really, for just crazy stuff to take root in public consciousness and affect society, you know, and lead to all kinds of abuse and all kinds of, like, false charges and, like, arrests and, like, lives being ruined and all kinds of things. You know, look up these kind of things on Wikipedia, if you will. Satanic ritual abuse. Michelle remembers. And the McMartin preschool trial. I'm not going to elaborate on what these things are, but if you read these things and you look at the kind of crazy stuff which comes up on Wiki and, you know, and the kind of crazy things that people did around these things, around these cases, you know, you're going to see the kind of, like, things that reactionaries can get you to believe and get you to do. You know, and get working people to turn against each other and all kinds of stuff. You know, like, this is the kind of stuff that that I've been talking about, like, you know, with racism, with regard to sexism, with regard to all the different things I mentioned, like, especially during Black History Month, the way that ruling class interests work to divide working class people, turn us against each other, get us to persecute each other. One of the things I'm reading right now, the book I'm actually reading right now, is on the witch hunts in early modern Europe. And as I'm learning now, that was an essential part of capitalism asserting itself, you know, in the 16th and 17th centuries and stuff like that. You know, capitalism is rising in Europe. And one of the things that it had to do was beat down popular social movements and the ways of life that existed before. You know, in England, in France, in Germany, all these different places. One of the ways it did that was by targeting women. Hundreds of thousands of them burned at the stake. On charges of witchcraft, consorting with the devil, you name it. You know, and, you know, and they conducted all kinds of scare campaigns, obviously, surrounding that. And, like, you know, made people afraid, made people terrified of their own neighbors. And this is the kind of thing reactionary politics does. It plays on fear. Plays on ignorance. That's what the reason why we need knowledge. Working people need knowledge of themselves if we're going to resist that kind of stuff. If we're going to fight for our own interests and we're going to really make the world a better place. So I think that's a pretty good segue into actually what I'm going to play next. Is first I'm going to play a song. And then I'm going to play Michael Parenti's talk on the political uses of religion, which I think is a pretty good place to go after, given what I've just talked about. You know, once again, we can't allow ourselves to be taken advantage of as working people. We need awareness. We need understanding of who we are and what our real interests are and who our real enemies are. If we're really going to fight back, we're really going to make this world a better place. We can only rely on ourselves. We have to organize ourselves. This is not rocket science. This has been done many, many times before, and we have to do it again. We can do it in this country. It's been done before in this country. And this is what we have to do as working people. We have to fight for our own interests, because no one is going to do it for us. Very, very important to understand. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR, brothers and sisters.
He's going to be addressing us today on theocracy versus democracy, the political uses of religion. And I have to say, in all the things that I've read over the years, when I came to Michael Parenti's works, I finally really found somebody that I agreed with, and the same goes for Dr. O'Hare, on this particular subject, and not alone that we agreed with, but somebody who was willing to actually say it out loud, or put it right out in a book somewhere for somebody to see, and I think you'll find what he has to say very interesting. Michael Parenti.
Thank you, John, and thank you, everyone, for having me here today. A few years ago, I went on a yoga retreat in the Caribbean, a little island. It's an ashram where people practice yoga. I went because I like yoga. Unfortunately, the head of this yoga sect was there, the head Swami, a very religious man, and he gave sermons every morning, which the guests were required to attend. And every day he talked about love and the higher cosmic force of love. And every day he talked about how spiritual things are everything and material things are nothing. He was an Indian. You say spiritual things are everything, material things are nothing. And then one day his yacht got loosed from the pier and it began to float away. And he started to scream and say, "Get my yacht, get my yacht." And he had a yacht and he had a seaplane. And this man of love, I noticed, was filled with hate. He yelled at people. This man of God was full of ego. He got up and talked about how no one is perfect, only I am perfect. He kicked out a couple of people from the place because they raised some questions, and he threatened to bring the police in. And it occurred to me that this Swami was the perfect theocrat, that what we had here was a theocracy, using the power of the state to enforce your will and countenancing no alternative opinions and up to your ears in wealth. In a theocracy, there's no democracy. Now, religionists say that they're anti-materialist. They're against materialism. But that word materialism is a very funny one. It's subject to a number of misinterpretations. In fact, there are two real, quite different uses for the word. There's philosophical materialism, which argues, as you know, that ideas do not exist as independent forces, independent of material reality, as disembodied mystical forces. As the great materialist Karl Marx said, men sometimes get ideas in their head and they're so vivid that they then impute to these ideas an external existence of their own as some force out there. Now, the religionists, to be sure, are anti-materialist in that sense. That is, they believe in these spirits and they believe in these externalized imaginings. But there's a second use of the word materialism. And when we use it, we often use it, I think, instinctively, quite correctly. We associate it with consumerism, self-interest, power, possessiveness, what I would call acquisitive materialism. And now here, most religious organizations really are very dedicated to this kind of materialism. They acquire, throughout the centuries, they have acquired, and in many different cultures, in many different countries, in many different eras, the one thing all these religions have had in common, almost all of them, is that they have acquired vast properties and wealth, and they have used political power. They've used the legitimated authority of the state, the legal use of organized force and violence, which is Max Weber's definition of the state. They've used political power to advance their own material interests, to win gain for themselves, to exploit people, and in fact to maybe often win advantages over competing religious sects, because there are often fights between each other for who's going to grab the goodies. And for centuries they've been involved in secular intrigues, in conflicts, in wars, in ways that have often violated their own religious precepts. Let me give you just one example from the thousands of examples from history that I could give you. Martin Luther. Now, we all know the Martin Luther who started the Reformation with his anti-materialist rebellion against Rome. But there's another lesser-known Luther, the other materialist kind of Luther, the apologist for the German princes, the defender of the aristocratic class rule, the Martin Luther who, in 1525, when the peasants were starving, when their land had been taken, when they couldn't even get a decent amount of firewood to heat themselves, when the children were going hungry, when the rents were crushing them, and they were desperate, and they rose up in rebellion in 1525, and they took over the cathedrals, and they took over the castles, and they formed committees, and they reorganized the use of the wealth, and they reorganized the use of the land for themselves, and they rose up with dignity. That Martin Luther got up, and this is what he said. He said, this is a blasphemy. He cursed the rebellion for turning, quote, everything upside down like the worst disaster. By the way, his own prince, Frederick the Wise, says this. Let me quote him first. He said, in many ways, the poor folk have been wronged by the rulers. Take something when a prince admits that. And now God is visiting his wrath upon us. But not Luther. Luther knew which side God was on, and God is on the side of the aristocracy. And he said, I don't quote him, is everything upside down like the worst disaster. And Martin Luther repeatedly urged, quote, everyone who can to, quote, smite, slay, and stab the peasants, secretly or openly, remembering that nothing can be more poisonous, hurtful, or devilish than a rebel. It is just as when one must kill a mad dog. And, of course, he quoted numerous passages from the Bible to justify his call to butchery. And the German princes didn't need too much encouragement. They slaughtered 100,000 peasants. And historians agree that that's pretty much the estimate that could stand. So this Luther, the great spokesman for the one true God of love and the Prince of Peace, was up to his neck in homicidal bloodletting in a repressive class war on the side of those who have more than they know what to do with against those who want a fair shake. Now, sometimes it works the other way. Sometimes the religionists use the state to advance their interests. That's what we mean by the religious uses of politics. And sometimes the state uses religion to legitimate its own exploits, and that's the political uses of religion. So politicians use religion, and religionists use politicians. This is not to say that nothing's changed. Indeed, there have been remarkable historical developments over the centuries. There have been remarkable victories for our forces. There's been a rollback of theocratic power. I mean, compared today to the 10th century, let's say. The diminishment of religious wars in the West, and the secularization of social life, with the advent of science, and with such forces as industrialization, urbanization, and modern socialism. But these advances don't come, and history doesn't work in a neat historical succession. Just when we think it's going one way, much to our dismay, it starts going another way. But generally, the move has been in a positive direction. But remarkable residues of the past are still with us. When you think about it, it was just 30 years ago that there existed an age-old theocracy. I mean, a theocracy that was about 2,000 years old. The society was still organized that way, in Tibet. And when the People's Republic of China reclaimed its citizenry over Tibet and sent its troops in and its organizers and its social welfare people, all these people came in, the U.S. media were filled with stories about these beautiful monks who had to be carried to India, who are now deprived of their religion. They weren't deprived of their religion. You could practice Buddhism in China if you want. What they were deprived of was their enormous wealth. The thing that the